Our prelude is Salam Shalom by Rafi. It will be performed by the Prairie Choir, directed by Barb Park, and today accompanied by Dan Proud.
I'm director.
Directed by Dan.
Barb is sick.
Ah, that was not on my script. Apologies.
Okay. There will be an opportunity for our audience participation, so join us as you, as your spirit moves you, okay?
Clapping. One, two, three, four. Salam Shalom, Salam Shalom, side by side we live Salam Shalom, Salam Shalom, Salam Shalom, side by side we sing Salam Shalom. Children of Israel, children of Palestine, to live, a time to shine. Salam Shalom, Salam Shalom, side by side we live Salam Shalom, Salam Shalom, Salam Shalom, side by side we sing Salam Shalom. Ancient sand, holy land, holy land. Time for the pain to heal, a time to mend and understand. Salam Shalom, Salam Shalom, side by side. Salam Shalom, Salam Shalom.
Sister, brother, mother, father, learn a new dance, sing a new song, walk a new path, make a circle where we all belong. We all belong. Da 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 da. Salam Shalom, Salam Shalom, side by side we live Shalom Shalom, Salam Shalom, Shalom Shalom, side by side we sing Shalom Shalom, hand in hand we sing Shalom Shalom, side by side we sing Shalom Shalom. Side by side, we sing Salam Shalom.
Patty just told me that they learned that an hour ago. That was pretty impressive. Thank you, and good morning again, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is K.D. Thompson. My pronouns are they, them. I've been a member of Prairie for almost 8 years, and I'm currently a member of the Committee on Ministry. We welcome you. We know you come here for different reasons, to find community, to seek your spiritual and personal truths, to question, to nurture your heart and soul, to be nurtured, to explore new ideas, to find comfort, and perhaps to find the answers to some of your bigger questions. We welcome you. We know you come from different places, different religions, different beliefs, and different backgrounds. We hope you will find comfort, connection, challenge, and love here. We hope you will find ways to provide outreach to others in our congregation, in our local community, and in our world community. Our chalice lighting today is by Deborah Falk, and it will be read by Tuppence Vandervarst.
Oh, there you are.
We light this chalice, symbolic of the warmth of community and the brightness that love brings to the world, illuminating our search for justice and peace, light, that force that nurtures all living things, here in our midst in this flame, so tiny and so significant.
Thank you, Tuppence. Our opening music is number 168 in the Gray Hymnal, One More Step, accompanied by Tuppence on the piano. Please stand in body or in spirit. It's now time for our story for all ages. Our story is today is Homeland, My Father Dreams of Palestine by Hannah Mushabek, and it will be read by Reverend Ralph. Kids and adults are welcome to gather around Reverend Ralph to listen to the story. After the story, we'll sing our youth out. The lyrics are in the order of service.
Homeland. This is a story about a father and his dreams of Palestine. It begins where the children are lying in their bed, and this is a bedtime story. How many like to hear stories when they're ready to go to sleep? Do you like to have stories? Yeah. Okay, this is one. We wait in bed for our father to come home from work. We know he's coming when we hear the coins jingle in his pocket as he walks up the stairs. Sometimes he whistles us to sleep, and sometimes he tells us stories. We like the stories best. There's a story about he fed his neighbor Muhammad to so many beans that Muhammad farted powerfully enough to lift off the ground. And there are stories about our homeland, a place we've never been. Every summer, my father visited his grandparents, Tita Maria and Sido Abu Michel, who lived in the old city Jerusalem. The final day of one visit started with his favorite breakfast, kayak. And kayak, that's like a bagel. And it has Sesame Street, but it's a more flattened bagel. Tita Maria called through the window to a street vendor below. She dropped the basket on a rope and up it came. Delicious bread, still warm, filled the basket. No matter how much food my father ate, Tita Maria always told him, eat more, Habibi. His Sido was a stern-looking, tarbush-wearing, agila-puffing, mustached man. He was always busy with grown-up matters, but this morning Sido announced that together the two of them would visit the family cafe. It's a restaurant. Walking through the streets of East Jerusalem, my father and his Sido stopped every few paces to greet people and tell stories. Abu Michel was called Al-Mukhtar and head of the community, and he spoke many languages. They walked hand in hand through the bustling collection of colorful vendors. Men and women sold everything from olive oil soap with rose water, heaping bags of za'atar to gold jewelry and embroidered textiles. As they walked, they were serenaded by sounds of chanting of the Muzadin's call to prayer. That's the call from the top of the minaret of the mosque. And it's mixed with the ringing of church bells, because there are also cathedrals in Jerusalem. And the market vendors singing the praises of pickling cucumbers or prickly pears. They could hear the cheerful sounds of children practicing dabka dancing and the songs of Om Kalhom that blasted from radios on the windowsills. But what fascinated my father most was the juice vendor, a short man who carried a big tank filled with yalab on his back. He traveled by foot from neighborhood to neighborhood. To announce his arrival, he played beautiful, intricate rhythms using brass cups and saucers. But to Tata's horror, when my father practiced at home, he practiced the same rhythms, only using her best china. And sometimes china broke. Now a professional drummer, he shows me and my sisters the juice man's rhythms by drumming on our backs like musical messages. At the family cafe, my father was greeted quickly with one kiss on each cheek by Amu Mitri. He was then put to work cutting cucumbers, chopping parsley, and preparing plates of olives and pink pickled turnips. The cafe was a popular destination for great thinkers, poets, musicians, historians, storytellers gathered to listen to the exchange of ideas at Al-Mukhtar's cafe. With a rare smile, Sido signaled to my father to follow him down a hallway. Sido unlocked the iron gate and led him to a lush, sunlit garden. Hundreds of homing pigeons rustled in their wooden cages in the shade of a proud olive tree. The next moment, he released all the pigeons and skillfully guided them into a circle in the sky with the help of the only black piece of cloth tied to the end of a long stick. With a surprise and delight, my father asked, "Won't they fly away?" Sido shook his head slowly, the key swaying at his side. "This is their home." This was the last day my father saw his grandfather, the last time he saw Palestine. Our eyes were heavy with sleep, but we wanted to hear more. Show us the key, we cry. Show us the key. And my father produces the large, rusted old key to our family's home in Jerusalem. We know the ending of this story is not a happy one. We know that we may never sit and watch the juice man from Haffa Gate, but we whisper the hope of return as we turn out the light and say good night. And that's homeland. The homeland now called Gaza or East Jerusalem. Okay? Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
We'll now have a moment of silence. I'll ring the chime once at the beginning and again at the end of the time of silence. Our presentation today is titled My Journey to Gaza by Tzila Bar. Tzila Bar is a Madison-based artist, graphic designer, and has been a Palestine solidarity activist since 1985. Her day job is at UW-Madison, where I've gotten to know her as a colleague, where she is the assistant director of the Middle East Studies program. On both coasts, she has been an active member of anti-Zionist Jewish groups. Here in Madison, she is a founding member of Madison Rafah Sister City Project, where she was in charge of buying and selling crafts from Gaza and the West Bank. Please join me in welcoming Tzila Bar.
Hello. Where is the clicker? Okay, can you hear me? Okay. So maybe next slide. Anyway, thank you, everyone, for coming to this presentation, and thank you for inviting me. My name is Tzila. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and my neighborhood was mostly Jewish. I went to public schools that were mostly Jewish. I come from a large extended family that's Jewish, and so I was very, you know, deeply embedded in that culture. I had a very traditional Jewish upbringing, which means I went to public school and then three times a week I went to Hebrew school and, of course, all the Jewish holidays. And within that education, my teachers were either Holocaust survivors or Israelis. And we were taught Hebrew. We were taught about Judaism, including all the holidays. And we were taught about Israel. And we were taught about Jewish history. And Jewish history was, you know, since the diaspora, 5,000 years ago, we were, dispersed to all these different countries where we were sometimes treated well, sometimes not. Sometimes we were treated like second-class citizens, and sometimes we did well, and then sometimes the country we were in kicked us out and persecuted us. And then the Holocaust happened in World War II, where 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazis, and that was really when Zionism, which was actually invented in the 1890s as the idea of founding a homeland for Jews somewhere, that's really when it started to take off. And so the powers that be decided, okay, we're going to have Israel. So in general, my Jewish education, I came to realize years later, was sort of a braiding of three things: Judaism, Israel, and the Holocaust. And all three things were melded together. And so to criticize one meant criticizing all of them. And that's really important to understand. And then I was about in my early 20s, around 1982, and Israel invaded Lebanon back then, and it was pretty horrific. And I was old enough that I was living in D.C., I was reading the Washington Post, I read every single article about this, and I was horrified that what Israel was doing to the Lebanese civilians. And I had literally never heard anything negative about Israel. I was just completely shocked. I was trying to figure out what was happening here. And at the time, I was working for the Institute for Policy Studies, which is a left-wing think tank in D.C. So at that time, I was like protesting the, you know, apartheid South Africa. I was protesting the human rights abuses going on in El Salvador. And so I saw there was a disconnect. And I finally, after, you know, a few years, was just like, you know, I have to start criticizing Israel. It doesn't sit well with me. I mean, this was before the internet, before I even knew very much. And so I felt nauseous doing it. It was so difficult. But I found a group called Washington Area Jews for Israeli-Palestinian Peace. Most of them were much older than me, and I really learned a lot from them. And that was really started me on my journey. And I feel very, very deeply that I have a moral responsibility as a Jewish person to speak out against what Israel has done to the Palestinians for the past 75 years. I just felt like I had to do it, and I also had to do it as an American citizen because we support Israel. So I'll get more into that. Next slide. Wait, did you skip? Yeah, so in any case, I joined groups wherever I lived, including... that was a picture of Berkeley Women in Black in that other slide. I came here. I helped start Madison Rothfuss Sister City Project. I also started the Madison Chapter for Jewish Voice for Peace. So wherever I went, I started groups or joined groups. And so in 2012, and this was right after the Arab Spring, Mohamed Morsi came into power in Egypt, and that allowed a little bit more movement into Gaza. Gaza is incredibly difficult to get into. So we actually, it's almost impossible to get in from Israel. So we went to Cairo as part of a delegation, and this delegation was... let's see, I don't know, about 17 people here, led by Cindy and Craig Corey, who are the parents of Rachel Corey. And if you don't know about Rachel Corey, she was killed in, I think it was 2003, run over by an Israeli bulldozer trying to defend a Palestinian home. So we miraculously got in November of 2012. Next slide. And here we are. This is Michelle Ball, who is an activist here in Madison and a friend of mine. And yeah, it was just so incredible to be there. This is the room where you have to wait. And they were saying, hey, people can be here for weeks or months. We were there for 2 hours. It was so, yeah, it was quite exciting. Next slide. And this sort of is just quickly showing you Gaza and the West Bank. So 30-second history of Israel-Palestine. This map is often called the incredible shrinking Palestine. So you can see in 1946, before the founding of the State of Israel, what looks like here, you know, this sort of dark green is Palestinian land. The little white dots were Jewish land. And then in the UN partition plan, the Jews were given, I think it was 70-ish percent of this territory. And then it was broken up. The Palestinian land was broken up. And then in 1967, during that war, more land was grabbed. And now you can start to see, you know, very clearly the big blob is the West Bank. And then that tiny strip is Gaza. And then in 2008, you really see a lot of shrinking in the West Bank, where the Israelis, illegal Israeli settlements have moved in and made it into almost like Swiss cheese in the West Bank. Next slide. So just to give a quick synopsis of the Gaza Strip, you can see it's very small, 26 miles long, 3 to 7 miles wide, 146 square miles, 1.7 million people, one of the highest population densities in the world, and 75% of them are refugees from when Israel was founded in 1948. And so they fled from all these other villages. And so it's about the size of Philadelphia or Detroit. It's very tiny. And you can see one side is bordered by the, you know, the Mediterranean, and then the lower part is Egypt, and then the rest is surrounded by Israel. Next slide. So in Gaza, what happened is Hamas won a democratic election in 2006, and then Israel started to severely restrict people and goods coming in by air, land, and sea. So it's incredibly difficult for the population to get in or to get out anywhere. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's very, very difficult. Next slide. So this is when I was there. So you can sort of get a vague idea of what it was like even before the latest onslaught. 95% of the water in Gaza Strip is undrinkable. There's a water filter systems, and Israel would routinely bomb them. And then they wouldn't let them bring in materials to rebuild them because they were considered dual use, which means they could be used for military purposes. Sanitation, Israel prohibits equipment to fix and improve wastewater treatment plants as well as trash trucks. So we were wandering around in a bus all over the Gaza Strip, and you would occasionally see just huge piles of garbage. The healthcare was, you know, there were hospitals, but they were always really low on medication, radiotherapy, or MRIs or CT scans. So, for instance, if you had kidney problems or cancer treatment, it's almost impossible to get the treatment you need, and then you would have to apply to get to an Israeli hospital, you know, to be treated. And sometimes you were granted this permit, sometimes you weren't, and many people died because they weren't allowed, including children. Mental health, Gazans suffer tremendously from mental health problems because of the occupation and the routine bombings that occurred. Let's see, I think there was 2009, 2012, 2014, every couple years, Israel would go in and indiscriminately bomb. And then in terms of food, 44% of Gazans are food insecure. 80% receive some form of food assistance. And so here you see, this is a distribution area for UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Work Association. So it was like flour and that kind of food. Next slide. So as we walked around and as we bussed around, we would see destroyed homes everywhere. It's very difficult to rebuild because they don't allow cement factories, and so it was sort of everywhere. There's this this woman here. She's her home was destroyed, and so she had us come in, and which is very typical of Palestinians in Gaza. It was just incredible hospitality. That she cooked pita bread for us. I mean, it was just like, wow. It was very delicious, by the way. So anyway, next slide. Yeah, so more rubble. And then you could see along the frontage road where our hotel was, there was all these donkey carts that would be going back and forth, and they were driven by these young boys, and it was rubble that they were trying to take to other sites to use as material to build. Next slide. Wherever we went, we were surrounded by children. It was, you know, foreigners are very rare there, as you can imagine. And so we were kind of treated, people were looking at us like we were from Mars. I mean, they were like looking us up and down like, whoa. And children, wherever, they were just coming out of the woodwork to say hello to us, to shake our hands, to say what little English they had. 47% of the population is under 18. Next slide. More children. Next slide. Who knows where these kids now are in their 20s? Who knows where they are now? Next slide. This is just an example. We went all over. We went to human rights centers. We went to music schools. We interviewed fishermen. One of the things when we were staying at this beautiful hotel, which I'll show you photos of, is we would wake up every morning, like 5 in the morning, and you know when you're traveling, you're like really disoriented, and I would be like, I heard this like do 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 do. Do, 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 do. And I was like, what is like that scraping? What is my husband doing in the kitchen? Like, I was just like, wait, you know, where am I? And I went to the, you know, downstairs to the dining hall, and I was asking the people who work there, I was like, what is that sound in the morning? It was like, oh, it's the Israeli gunboats shooting at the fishermen. So they would change their rules. So they would be like, 3 kilometers, you're allowed. Oh, 6 kilometers. No, you're back to 2. And they would just shoot at these fishermen. And it was like these tiny little boats. Like, there wasn't anything military going on there. Some fishermen were killed. So to address that problem, and this shows the incredible ingenuity of the Gazans. They created fisheries. They produce a lot of fish, and this was a joint project with Malaysia. Next slide. We also visited the Rachel Corey Children and Youth Center, which was opened in 2003 to provide creative and educational opportunities for the kids. They had art classes, summer camps, and a variety of after-school programs. And the man here, his name was Anis Masor, and he came to Madison, and he now lives in Iceland. And that's sort of a sad part of when we visited Gaza. A lot of the young people were like, how do you get me out of here? You know, not because they, you know, aren't proud to be Palestinian or they don't want to stay there, but it's just the opportunities are so limited. Next slide. We also visited the Altfalna Society for the Deaf, which was just this huge building where they had all sorts of programming. For whatever reason, they have a higher than normal rate of deafness in Gaza. They had early intervention programs. They had a school for deaf children, speech therapy, and vocational training for the adults. And that vocational training was they taught them how to make the traditional Palestinian crafts and sell them. So this was the main place that I ordered crafts for 20 years. So what I'm wearing now is from there, and this is the traditional Palestinian embroidery, which is called Alta Trees. This is all done by hand. So it was very exciting because I had been ordering from them to finally see this place. Next slide. So you can see the adults are they're painting. There's a loom, and here's one of the classrooms. And we caused quite the stir in this classroom when we walked in. People were so excited to see us, and they were having a hard time settling in. But it was this bright, cheerful place. Next slide. And then we also visited UN Gender Project, which was a post-college graduate program that taught poor women computer skills, advanced English, and other work placement skills. Next slide. We also went to the Gaza Music School, which was developed in 2008, destroyed during Operation Cast Lead, which was, I think, 2009. Which was an Israeli bombing campaign where many people were killed. And then it was rebuilt, and it did enroll 120 children. Next slide. We also visited a farmer. Here he is. His name is Mohammed. He's both a farmer and a poet. And most of Gaza was just very sandy, you know, like I was saying, and a lot of rubble from the destroyed homes. And so it was really interesting to go to this part of Gaza, which is actually very close to the Israeli border, and it was a lot of green. And so it was an entire field of cabbages. So this man who, he's the self-proclaimed, you know, mayor of Rafah, he traveled with us and he like picked one up to show us. But they also, used to, produce most of the grapefruit for Europe, and that was closed off, because of the blockade. So that was quite interesting. And they also destroyed his house. So he had to rebuild. And so yeah, next slide. And this is the hotel we stayed at, and I had no idea like where we were going to stay. And it was, I have to say, it was one of the most beautiful hotels I've ever stayed at in my life. It was a lot of olive wood that was being used. I found out later that most of the material came through those tunnels. So, and it was right along the Mediterranean. So you could just see the potential of Gaza there. It was just really beautiful. And the entire time we were there, they were building this mosque. Next slide. And here's the entrance. And right here is El Mataf, means the museum. So they actually had a small little museum of artifacts that were dug up in Gaza that were, you know, thousands and thousands of years old. Next slide. And here's the some of the people from our trip and the Gazans. So this woman on the left, she was studying at the university there, and she wanted to practice her English. So she joins us every day, and she wanted to study Shakespeare. She was very interested in that, and she really wanted to go to a university outside of Gaza to study. And then on the right, it's Michelle and the interpreter, who was just a wonderful woman. And I went on a couple journeys without the group, and she came with me. And she's from Gaza, and the last night we were there, three Israeli bombs dropped near the hotel. And I can't even tell you how unbelievably frightening that is, to live in a place that's being indiscriminately bombed. And it was just a taste of what the Gazans have to put up with now. And they had to get put up with back then. And so so the interpreter was really, she didn't want to leave her family. And her family was like, no, you have to leave, But yeah, three bombs fell. It was incredibly scary. One of them was like a mile away. So yeah, the whole building shook. Next slide. And while I was there, I got, like many people sometimes do when they travel, I got food poisoning, and I got it worse than most people. So there was like a day or two where I just was like, you know, lying in the hotel room, and, you know, the hotel people were cleaning up after me, and they were giving me like pita bread and za'atar and tea to help. They were really sweet. And it was actually a really interesting experience, because I was hanging out in this hotel lobby, and it was sort of almost like a community center, and there were people coming in and out, and everyone wanted to talk to me. It was really fascinating. And, you know, some of them knew English. So I love that part too, the sort of impromptu conversations. And so one of them was this woman, this young woman, Sha'ad, who was had became Facebook friends with the man over there, Rich Forer, from New Jersey. And so she came to the hotel lobby, and I said, I'm not feeling so well. And she says, come to my house, and my mother will make you soup. And I was like, okay. You know, and they were like, oh, no, it's like, we're not doing it with the tour. I was like, I don't care. And so Rich came with me, and it was so wonderful to be in this Palestinian home. And this woman was, I think, her aunt, and she was sitting there, you know, grinding up these leaves, and I was like, you know, what is this? And I found out later she didn't speak English, but through everyone, I found out it's Malakia, which they grind up this leaf, and it's actually very nutritious, and they put it in soups. So the hospitality was just incredible. I mean, I got in. Wow. Okay, next slide. Sorry, I'm just talking. So Gaza in 2024. So as you know, October 7th of 2023, Hamas fighters, or Hamas, they came out of the prison of Gaza, and they murdered, 1,300 Israelis, and that was a war crime, and then Israel retaliated. And so you might have seen some of these photos or know some of these statistics. Something like 42,900 have been killed, 70% women and children, 7,000, they think it might be a larger number than that, that are missing and under the rubble, 1.1 million are living through food insecurity and disease due to unsanitary conditions. There's severe malnutrition. 34 kids have died from starvation. Each one of these numbers is a human being with hopes and dreams. Next slide. Lots of damage to facilities, buildings, hospitals, no schools, etc. Next slide. This is what happened to the Al-Fana Society that was bombed. They're still up and operating in like tents, trying to teach. Next slide. The founder of Al-Fana was murdered. Next slide. And our government is complicit. We send $38 million in military aid per day, $17.9 billion since October 7th, 2023. This is a clear violation of U.S. law, which bans the selling of weapons that are using them against civilians. Israel's the largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid since its founding. And the U.S. provides diplomatic cover in the U.N. and International Criminal Court. Next slide. And I'm just here to say that we can speak up. We can do things to change U.S. policy towards the blanket support of Israel. You can join a group. You can call your senators and congressmen. You can write letters to the editor and all sorts of things. So there's a pamphlet in the back if you want to know what you personally can do. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sila. Now is the time that our community dedicates for discussion around the focus of today's service, relying upon our covenant of good relations as a guide to ensure all voices are welcomed and relationships are valued. We have a few minutes for discussion, which needs to end by 10:55. Please come up and form a line on either side of the room or raise your hand and one of our helpers will bring you a microphone. Introducing yourself with your name and pronouns is welcomed. If you're on Zoom, type into the chat to have your comment read aloud.
For solutions. Remember, I should have bring that up.
Oh, okay, I'm not sure. Do you want to ask a question?
No, I was asking you.
Well, why don't you
speak here so everyone can hear you.
Is that how that works?
Yes.
Okay. I knew Michelle Ball. I was just asking her if she remembered me at all. That's where I know her from.
From a group or?
Yeah, from Journey.
From Journey.
Yeah.
Oh, Michelle Ball.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, she worked there. Yes.
Can you just tell her Jason Collins said hi?
Okay,
good.
I want to thank you so very much. I've known a number of Jewish people who are very concerned about what's been going on for years and years. And I'll just say, for those of you who don't know, my grandfather, who was a Quaker, worked for the United Nations in 1948 and he was in charge of food distribution out of Nazareth. And I got to travel with him in the Middle East. And so I learned the story of what had been happening then. And then we stayed with a family that he had helped escape to Beirut when we went to Lebanon. And so it's been very hard over the years. But I thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I'm wondering what kinds of things your group and other groups of Jewish people are doing that you think are most effective in terms of doing anything to change the horrible situation that somehow we've gotten into.
Yeah.
I would say it's a number of things that you can do, and I think one of them is to like I said, contact your senators and congressmen about how you feel. I think I believe it's Bernie Sanders who has put forth a bill to stop U.S. military aid to Israel. I think writing letters. I think educating the people in your community, like what I'm doing right now, is extremely important. There's lots of books and films and articles that you can read. I think participating in rallies and vigils when they come up, so you can get yourself on some mailing lists to find out about that. And there's another thing that's I think also quite crucial is becoming involved in the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And so that's when you participate in boycotting Israeli products and goods and divesting from Israel. That's incredibly important, and I'm part of a group of community members who are researching that. And I think we're also doing that on campus as well. So that's also a really important thing you can get involved in. And also fundraising. I guess that's another thing. Fundraising.
Hello, my name is Andy, he, him, his, and I want to thank you so much for a wonderful program. I want to thank you for all you're doing for justice around the world. I have a couple questions. I was hoping you could explain to us the two-state solution, and how much pushback are you getting from people of the Jewish faith, and do you see any separation from the support that Jewish people give to Israel, sort of blank check?
So regarding two state versus one state, so the two state solution, that's been around for a while, and it's becoming harder and harder to implement right now, because when they tried to implement it several years ago, it was really, it became more of a land grab for Israel. So, you know, a two state solution where it's the West Bank and Gaza, where they're separated from each other, it's not going to be really viable for the Palestinians. I mean, I've thought about it. It's like really the only way you could really do it fairly, where both Israel and Palestine have access to international borders, have access to the sea. You would have to sort of divide it almost like, you know, North and South Vietnam or North and South Korea. I think it's going to be incredibly challenging. So there's many people who've just like, this is not going to work. So then the other solution would be, you know, a one state solution where it's a truly democratic society for everyone who lives there. Right now, it really isn't. There's the Palestinians who live in what they call pre-67 borders. They're called the Israeli Palestinians. There's many laws against what they can or cannot do. So something where that's the what has been described as the apartheid system of Israel is dismantled, and people live side by side. So that's the other solution. And then getting to Jewish opinion on this, it is changing. It's because I've been an activist on this for so long. I used to try to argue with my family about it, or debate, and it's just become too painful, and it's become the elephant in the living room. I had Zionist Jewish friends here in Madison. I've don't really talk to them. They don't talk to me. So I've developed my own network of, you know, Jewish people who are willing to criticize Israel at this point. So it's become incredibly divisive within the Jewish community. And I think that the solution in the past was always to just bury it underground, and now it's just, you know, percolating. So I do think that things are changing within the American Jewish community and their attitude towards Israel. I think mostly that is coming from the younger generation, who is just not buying it anymore. They're not buying the programming. Like I was describing how I grew up in the 60s and 70s when there was no internet. Like, you know, the younger people are being exposed to all sorts of things that I wasn't exposed to, and, you know, videos and articles. And so they're moving to a point where they're becoming extremely critical of Israel. And people my age are starting to get there. But so things really are shifting, and you can see that there's like the I believe it's the one and only out and out anti-Zionist synagogue is in Chicago, and it's called Tzedek, and it's Rabbi Brant Rosen. So things are changing, and I think Judaism, at least in the United States, could really change in the future and not be so blindly pro-Israel.
Thank you again. We're sharing our offering this quarter. We're sharing our offering this quarter with Porchlight's Dwelling Intervention Grants and Sustenance Program, which provides eviction prevention counseling and financial assistance to households facing eviction. Our offertory is May It Be by Enya and Nick Ryan, performed by Tuppence.
Shines down upon you, may it be when darkness falls, your heart will be true. You walk a lonely road, oh, how far you are from home. Mornie, utulie, believe and you will find your way. Mornie, alantie, a promise lives within. The shadows call, will fly away. May it be you journey on to light the day. When the night is overcome, you may rise to find the sun. Mornie, utulie, believe and you will find your way.
Our closing words are by Shari Woodbury and will be read by Karen Smith.
Let us continue to grow as citizens of our communities, our nation, and our world. Let us work to build the common good for ourselves and the generations to come. May it be so. Blessed be.
Our closing music is Strangest Dream by Ed McCurdy, led by Dan Proud. The lyrics are on the back of the order of service. Please rise in body or in spirit.
I dreamed I saw my
think this is off. Okay, thank you, Dan. We have a few announcements. Next Sunday is our All Souls Day service. We will be remembering loved ones who are no longer with us. Attendees are invited to briefly share a memory and bring pictures or mementos of your loved ones to place on a common display table. Also next Sunday in Religious Exploration, we're having a Halloween party for our young people. If you'd like, you can bring candy or trinkets for prairie trick-or-treaters. Stand in the foyer or outside the main entrance to admire their costumes and distribute goodies. Today, after the service, Interweave, our LGBTQ plus and questioning folks group, as well as allies, is meeting in the annex next door. Everyone is welcome. And we have some snacks. Also, today after the service, there is a Prairie Leadership Forum starting at noon in this room. This meeting is for all committee chairs or assigned representatives and board members. Interested members are also welcome to attend and listen in. There are a few more announcements in your order of service and the News of the Week email. At this time, we are stopping our recording.